First of all, I'm Megan. I'm an alcoholic. I'm day 623 today, which I'm very proud of, coming up for my 2 year anniversary on the 1st of September. I chose emotional sobriety because I thought not only is it important to talk about the other parts of sobriety that isn't just simply the abstinence part, but also because I'm someone who's probably gone through more therapy than anyone I know on the planet. And I have an honorary doctorate in healing myself. So I thought, I think I've got a few things to share with you all to save you the tens of thousands of dollars that I've spent on therapy over the last few years. So if I can do that for one person, then I've made a difference in the world. So once I started looking into this concept of emotional sobriety, and I was looking at the key components of what that entails, I realized pretty quickly that every single step related back to the big book, which of course is no surprise to us because those of us who've read the big book know that it was before its time, exceptionally forward-thinking, modern in its approach, beyond any of the medical, I guess, fraternity that were talking about addiction at the time, and still, nearly 100 years later, is proving to be the blueprint, really, for how to dig underneath the reasons why we are drinking. If it was just about giving up drinking, everybody would do it, and it would be easy, and we would do it the first time. But the average time it takes for someone to get sober is 7 times. That's the average. So I heard somebody share before in the Newcomers Day Count that they, sort of reluctantly saying that they've tried 3 times. You're ahead of the curve. You're ahead of the curve. So you've got to think this is a really, really tough nut to crack. And I truly believe the only way to crack it is to get under the hood and to talk about that emotional sobriety. Abstinence doesn't work. I had 7 years of being a dry drunk, as we call it in the program. So somebody who was an alcoholic who was abstaining from alcohol but hadn't done any of the work to support myself. 7 years. And I thought that I was good. And then when I relapsed, I'm just going to grab some water. Sorry. When I relapsed, as we all know, and as the book tells us, because it's so smart, I was worse than I ever was before because I'd done no work on myself. My coping mechanism was to turn to alcohol and food. I had a food addiction as well. I put on about 60 kilos in, which is for Americans and, like 150 pounds, 160 pounds in my adult life. And I sort of oscillated between turning to alcohol, turning to food, turning to both at the same time. So when anything happened to me, I would turn to those things as my crutch. I had to learn a new crutch. And the very first thing that you need to do that, the very first step in emotional sobriety is self-awareness. So you can't fix what you don't acknowledge. So unless you say to yourself, this is not working for me, this is not working for my life, then you can't take a step forward. And we call those people unfortunates in the big book. And they are the people who unfortunately do not have the ability to have self-awareness. And we don't want to be those people. And I don't think anyone in this room is that person because you wouldn't be here. So it's very, very important to have self-awareness and to accept deep down that this is no longer working. Let me just check my trusty little notes here. So self-awareness, which when I looked into it, really is step four, a fearless moral inventory, really getting to the nitty-gritty of what it is that you've been doing to others, how you've made it about yourself. Alcoholics are some of the most selfish people, but you know what? Alcoholics are some of the nicest, most beautiful, honest people that you've ever met. I once heard a quote years and years ago that somebody would trust an addict lying in a gutter more than they would trust a sold-out CEO with 50 Ferraris, because one person, as in the addict in the gutter, is at least being honest about their pain. They're at least being honest about the fact that their life is no longer working. That checked out CEO with 50 Ferraris wouldn't even know what an emotion felt like anymore. And I agree with that. So alcoholics are awesome people because we're actually showing our pain. We're actually showing that we're not coping. So in essence, by our addiction, we are showing that self-awareness because we're saying to the world, we're not coping. We need some other way of coping. The next step is emotional regulation, which relates, if I refer to my little trusty notes, which really is step 10, which encourages immediate identification of emotions like fear or anger and fostering real-time management of reactions. So you're self-aware, you realize this isn't working for you anymore. You're regulating your emotions in a healthy way, not an unhealthy way. So a perfect example of that for me is this past week when I came back from Bali, I was on holidays. I got influenza A, which is probably the sickest I've ever been in my entire life. Today's the first day I can actually sit up. And I nearly considered not being able to do this talk. But nothing was going to keep me away from talking to you guys today. So my normal reaction to an extreme overwhelm of physical pain, emotional turmoil, I couldn't be there for my son. He was crying for me. He wanted me to pick him up. I had no strength to pick, I couldn't walk to the bathroom. I needed my husband to help me go to the bathroom. And my son wanted me to pick him up. My heart was breaking. My mum is in hospital. I haven't been able to visit her. This is like Megan's recipe for absolute emotional destruction. It was almost like if I designed the perfect storm to bring me undone, this was it. And I was like, okay, all right, I see this. I see this for what it is. So self-awareness, I see the challenge. I see what's trying to bring me undone. And at no point, funnily enough, did I want to turn to alcohol, probably because I was too sick to even sip water. I didn't crave alcohol, but I did have some dark thoughts and I did consider, is this all worth it? Because I felt so insanely ill and such a failure as a mother and as a daughter. So in my normal world, before my emotional sobriety, I would have just checked out, drank, not had any responsibility for my family, but I didn't. I stayed in bed. There were days I slept 23 out of 24 hours, but I did what my body needed. And slowly, slowly, which I'm not good at, I'm a bull at a gate, slowly, day by day, got better. So emotional regulation is exceptionally important. It's that knee-jerk reaction where you're going to reach for that drink or you're reaching for that chocolate bar or something that's going to give you that relief, stopping, looking at the bigger picture and working out how you can make a conscious decision to do something that's going to help you and not hinder you. The third one is having healthy relationships. And I've put this as the entire AA program. So peer support through honesty and sharing in AA meetings. So healthy relationships are exceptionally important and you know, is the cornerstone of this program. So you can see we're halfway through the six steps of emotional sobriety, and every single one has related back to the big book so far. Having these relationships, dialing into meetings, having those moments of celebration at the beginning of meetings, saying the we, being part of a collective. When I was in and out of rehab three times a couple of years ago, and when I got out the third time, I wanted to do a peer support program, like a study course, because I was really, really interested in this concept of peer support and how important it is and how complementary it is to traditional therapy. So I did a little bit of research for you guys just to show you how important programs like this, which I would call a peer support program, so people with experience, not degrees, who are sharing their experience with each other. And what it said, let me get this right. I want to make sure it is correct. So peer support in many contexts is as effective as clinical support, but this should always be engaged alongside structured clinical support, but as effective than somebody with a PhD in psychology. This isn't a joke. AA is not a fun place to rock up every day and have a quick chat. This is changing lives, listening to other people's experiences, hearing their pitfalls, hearing their wins. This is all going into our brains. You have no idea how many times I'm driving along and something comes into my head that somebody said a year ago in a meeting, and I remember how life-changing that was. And I never would have heard that from a doctor. And I have doctors. I have doctors coming out the yin yang. Don't you worry about that. I've got an entire team of medical people that are supporting me on my journey. And I have never heard from any of them. They help me with a whole bunch of other stuff, but I've never heard them say some of the wisdom that I've heard in these meetings. They are so important because the doctors, as important as they are, have not been an alcoholic. They have not had to make that choice between a drink and looking at the disappointment in their husband's eyes when you're drunk again and hiding alcohol. They've never had that experience. And money and degrees can't buy that experience. So these meetings are so important in your journey towards emotional sobriety, actually getting under the hood of what's going on here so that we can truly heal and truly move forward with our life free, as the big book says. The problem doesn't exist anymore. It's been removed completely. And that's the place that you can all get to. The fourth step in emotional sobriety is mindfulness and presence, which relates to step 11, which is really about prayer and meditation. So again, the big book nails it. It already had it right at the end. Just when we thought it was over, it remembered we need to self-reflect. We need prayer and meditation. We need mindfulness. And that's those moments I was just talking about before where I wanted to spiral this week and I stopped. I stopped myself. I checked myself and I thought, are these thoughts true? I was thinking ridiculous things like, my mum's going to die in hospital and I'm never going to see her again. My son's going to hate me because I can't pick him up. This influenza is going to kill me. I'm going to die. These are some of the catastrophic thoughts that I was having. And I said to myself, is that true? Well, yes, of course, any of those things can happen, including my mum passing away in hospital because she's very sick. But is it likely? Is this my brain tricking me? Second guess, not every single thing that comes into your brain is true. Your brain is set up to protect you in a primal way. So it thinks it's helping you by raising the alert and saying, danger, danger. But you've got to be the sense check that says, this is not a dangerous situation. All I have to do is get better. So my advice in the mindfulness area is to also bring in a sense of sense checking those catastrophic thoughts. And if you're like me, I live in a catastrophic thought bubble most of the time. So it's very, very difficult for me to bring myself down, but I've had to learn. It's taken a long time. It's like going to the gym, building a muscle. You've just got to keep working at it, but you can strengthen that muscle. The fifth step is spiritual growth. And I think we all know the first step of, first and second step of AA is all about commitment to a higher power and admitting that we are powerless over alcohol. So, again, the big book nailed it from the gates. So we came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. Step two, spiritual growth. Whatever that means for you. For me personally, during this process, that meant finding Christianity and being baptized. I'd never been baptized as a child. My parents had allowed my sisters and I to choose our own religion, which was very forward-thinking for the 80s. And much to everybody's surprise, after being virtually an atheist most of my life, after coming to AA and really connecting with my higher power, it felt important to me to formalize that relationship. That's obviously not everyone's path, and that's okay, but that's my path. And that's really helped me in terms of a solidification of my values and my commitment to sobriety and my commitment to my family and my friends around me and to you guys. You know, my values are very, very important to me. And that's another thing I wanted to mention is it's actually a really good exercise to write down what you feel your values are, because when we're alcoholics and we're in active addiction, we throw those out the window. And that's what makes us feel like terrible people. It's not necessarily that we're drinking per se. It's that when we drink, we drop our values, and everybody has them. You innately know what they are. Write them down. Have a moment of mindfulness and reflection and write down what you think your values are. To me, one of my core values is transparency. I am pathologically incapable of lying, which actually gets me into trouble, because sometimes it's kind to lie a little bit. And sometimes I get a little bit of flack for being too honest, but I would take that over not being transparent any day. But as I've gotten older, I've had to learn that complete transparency doesn't necessarily mean, well, because one of my values is also kindness. So those two things can't always exist at the same time. So once you write down your values, you start to see how they interplay with each other, which is a really, really interesting process, because which one wins when I have something to tell somebody that actually isn't kind, but it's truthful? Which one wins? I have to pick. And I can't pick if I'm drunk. I can't pick if I'm not mindful, if I'm not being spiritual, if I'm not emotionally regulating myself. All of these things tie together in a big pie. They're not separate things. So that's number five. And number six is continuous learning, which is step 12. Having had a spiritual awakening as a result of
10
these
minutes,
steps.
Megan.
Thank you. Having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all our affairs. So continuous learning. So that is, you're not going to be perfect. You're going to fail. You're going to have bad days. You're going to have catastrophic thoughts. You're going to think the whole world's falling down. You're going to think your mum's going to die. Not to beat yourself up about that. Just get back on the horse and keep going, one step at a time. As we say, one day at a time. And the cumulative effect of building those muscles of resilience and self-love and self-reflection grows over time, and you get more and more and more strength. I just had a little anecdote I wanted to share. 95% of cancers are lifestyle and environmentally related. Only 5% are hereditary. So we wouldn't just get chemotherapy and go back to our regular life and do nothing. We would make significant lifestyle changes to prevent that from happening again. And the same goes for our sobriety. It's exactly the same thing. So if you were really sick, you got the chemo, you got better, you got through your cancer diagnosis, you wouldn't just go back to eating McDonald's every day and living in a house that's unsafe with mold. You would change your circumstances. And that is exactly the same with sobriety. We have to change everything about the way that we live, the way that we think. And that takes time, but it is possible. I promise you, it is possible. I think that's all my things. Oh my goodness. I came in. Oh, perfect. Look at that. Perfect timing. That's it. Thank you, guys.